Rush Lep Them Doggies, Shine Your Spittoon, and get ready for high noon, because it's Punk News Podcast number 253. Welcome back to the Punk News Podcast. This is Don Juan. Tonight, it's the good, the bad, and the ugly. One of the main guys, we're here with the High Plains Drifter. Down below the Rio Grande, they call him Adam Blanco, the High Plains Drifter. Always with the 10-gauge at his side and the big floppy hat with the little balls hanging across it. High Plains Drifter, Adam White, are you ready for tonight's showdown?
I don't know what's more disgraceful, your absolute inauthentic accent that you have here, or your inability to remember the lingo that you need to pull the accent off. I don't know if they would call them floppy hats with little dangly balls.
Well, out there
in the real country, John.
Well, those Spanish gunfighters. I was trying to make you look cool, Adam, like the cool Spanish gunfighter guy.
And all John, I don't need you to make me look cool.
And we also have here with us Ricky the Kid, the quickest six gun this side of the Mississippi. He's quick with the two guns. Bang, bang, bang. Tricky Ricky, do you have itchy trigger fingers tonight?
Like Martin Short and the Three Amigos. Yeah.
Well, there you have it. Ricky's comparing himself to a comedy. And this is Johnny G, features editor Don Juan, the third of the good and the bad and the ugly. You can guess which is which. And we are here with a Mexican standoff. Let's get started tonight. First of all, let's wrap it up. Let's mention it one last time, the cassette tape. It's been manufactured. It's been packaged. It's been shipped. We're getting some pretty good feedback. People are digging it. I'm excited. I got to say, boys, not to pat ourselves on the back, but I think we did a pretty kick-ass job.
Yeah, it's awesome. I told you before we started recording, I got mine, and I just got to get a working cassette player.
Yeah, I wonder what population of people that own one of these has no means of playing it.
Yeah, that's a good question. I wonder like what percentage actually listens to them, but that's part of the joy. What is interesting about it is it really did underscore what we say all the time. The vast majority of people that bought them, 90 to 95% of the people that bought them, are not regular Punk News commenters. So it just goes to show, as always, the commenters do not represent the readers of Punk News. We've said it a million times, but we're just going to keep saying it. I think the tape turned out pretty well, really well. I know a lot of the bands were psyched. Like I said, it was kind of a culmination of my 10 years of doing interviews and that kind of stuff. So I think it turned out pretty well. We've just got about 5 copies left. So if you want to order a copy, you definitely should order a copy. You can find it if you just go to Google, put Punk News Mixtape, and it'll come right up, or maybe Punk News My Org Mixtape. And then after that, it's gone. I've got a couple of other irons in the fire that are related to this that aren't this. But I'm thinking I want to do a sequel. I just don't know if we did a sequel, would the momentum build? Like with each one, would we get a bigger and bigger interest? Or is just the novelty of this what made this one do okay? And if we did a sequel, it would not do as well. What do you guys think? Like, if we did a sequel, would it pay off?
I think you need to let some time go by in between.
Yeah, we're talking like six. I'd love to do one every 6 months, but probably more really? Like every year is probably more likely.
I think every year is the way to go. You don't want to lose like its luster after like 3, you know, too fast. Like if you do 3 like in a year or 2 in a year, I feel like that might kind of go. It might become just a regular thing. It won't be like as special, maybe. But so I would go for once a year. I think that'd be very cool. But that's just my opinion.
I got an idea here. So what you need to do is, so the first year out that they're going to do this, you get a bunch of bands together and you get them to cover songs from like another genre, and you can call it like all those bands got to be punk bands, right? So then what you can do is you can call it like punk, you know, goes genre, and you can use the genre name. But then each year that we do this, it's got to get more sad and more weird. Where like we stop where the lines start to blur, John, where at one point we're going to call it like, you know, the Johnny G punk is pop mixtape, but the punk bands are just going to be pop bands anyways, but they're going to be pop bands that no one gives a shit about. And they'll cover pop bands that people do give a shit about. And the result is going to be horrible, but I bet you it'll sell like a billion copies.
And I'm just,
there's no historical precedent for this. It'll be great.
And just to add on to that, you might want to get Ronnie Radke to cover, you know, a famous 90s rap song. That might work too.
Yeah, no, wait, fuck, hold on. Scratch the whole plan. Ronnie Radke, 12 tracks, do him whatever he wants.
Let's put out a Ronnie Radke mixtape, and he can do his line, "I'll be shitting on you rappers like I'd be shitting in Pampers." The greatest diss ever, I gotta say. You heard it here, folks. Next punk news mixtape, it's not even gonna be a mixtape. It's just gonna be Ronnie Radke's next rap album. That's what we're gonna do.
So no, we can do better than that. Our next mixtape will be Ronnie Radke's Twitter account. So you already have it. You can just go there.
Can we just say it's our mixtape? Like, yeah. We advertise Punk News puts out a mixtape. Click here to go.
It's just a link.
Speaking of things that are stranger than fiction, a little while ago we talked about how Andrew WK now has a weekly radio show on the Glenn Beck Radio Network. Well, Dallin wrote in about our opinions on the thing. Basically, I think our opinions was, we thought it was a little weird, but we think it's cool that Andrew WK is bringing his message to an audience that probably would not normally hear his message. Adam, was that about your summation of the whole thing?
I feel like I was pretty, you know, down the middle and kind of like non-confrontationally Canadian about the whole thing, but maybe I was wrong.
Well, Dallin didn't read it that way at all, Adam. Here's what Dallin said. "I've been a listener of the Punk News podcast pretty much from the beginning, since the days of Brian and Rich, and I love the show."
Oh, man, this guy's got cred.
"I recently listened to the podcast where you guys were baffled by Andrew WK's decision to host a radio show on Glenn Beck's Blaze Network, and I was equally baffled by some of your comments. Glenn Beck is definitely wacky, and he can be kind of nuts, but he's not a hate monger. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems so obvious that you guys haven't done your homework on Glenn Beck and don't know very much about him. Glenn Beck repeatedly talks about how he is not anti-gay marriage. He repeatedly states he doesn't care one bit if homosexual people get married, and in return, he asks that no one force churches to do anything against their religious beliefs. From everything I've heard, he is adamantly and passionately anti-racist and anti-homophobic. He repeatedly talks about how we need to love each other and both sides of the political spectrum need to listen to each other. He wanted Andrew WK because Andrew is compassionate and always willing to listen to different points of view. Andrew WK's message is about loving one another and not about being bigoted, including bigotry towards religious conservatives. In fact, Andrew WK and Glenn Beck have a lot more in common than you think. If this sounds crazy to you, again, I think it's because you have never genuinely listened to Glenn Beck. To be honest, I was not expecting any of you to be Glenn Beck fans, and you would probably disagree with much, if not most, of what he says. But I was surprised when John G. called him a hate monger. That's all I wanted to say. I like both Glenn Beck and Andrew WK. I often have opinions different from most punk rockers, but I very much enjoy listening to what they have to say, as long as they are well informed. Well, thank you for writing in, Dallin. We appreciate it.
I fully admit to having done no research on Glenn Beck. He basically exists to me as a cartoon character and not a real person. And the amount of legitimate listening to Glenn Beck and then making a decision that I've ever done in my life is probably nil. But I don't know. I'll live with that.
Can I throw my two cents in real quick? Because I did listen to the episode, but I wasn't on it. So
why'd you write us this letter?
I'm sorry. I know.
Why couldn't you just talk to us?
yeah, and I would have said that I've been listening to the show since the beginning. You know, to call him a hate monger now, I don't know if he is. I think what he is, he's a fear monger for sure, especially when he was on Fox. I kind of change channels when I'm like watching the news. Like one time, just to make sure I know who is still on, just so I know like what's being framed here, what the story is being framed on another channel. So I think it's important to know who all these people are and just to kind of get an idea of what they do. I think since leaving Fox News, Glenn Beck has actually kind of become less of an asshole. And he kept calling himself a libertarian and stuff like that. And if you look at the Libertarian Party set of like pretty much core beliefs, he's really none of those. He's kind of one of those. He probably came off more as those crazy like Tea Party people that really aren't, I would argue, the same thing as someone who's in the Libertarian Party here in America. I would say now he's calmed down since leaving Fox News, and he's become less of a fearmonger and less hateful towards everyone. So I mean, probably back on Fox, he was probably more of a hate monger. I don't think so anymore. He led a lot of hysteria, like I said. But I don't think Andrew WK would have. He comes off as like a really smart guy. I don't think he would have taken this job as like if Glenn Beck was still doing what he was doing on Fox News. I have a feeling he could have easily gotten a job like on Sirius Radio or somewhere else on terrestrial radio. So it's not like Andrew WK is this punk rock guy that's saying, fuck major labels, fuck all, everything else in society, anarchy, man. I think overall it was probably a good decision. It's probably good for his career overall. And I don't think he would have done it if he thought this was going to damage his career.
Well, there you have it, the voice of Ricky Frankel giving business decisions regarding to Andrew WK. And in unrelated mail, if you guys remember last week, we put out a question. The question, briefly summarized, was this, because it was brought up by Jared. Recently, at least four bands have had the following issue. The issue is the following, is four separate bands, not related to each other in any way, members have been accused of rape or sexual assault or something like that. People have taken those bands and basically said so-and-so is a rapist, so-and-so is a sexual assault person on Facebook in mass, all over, basically large campaigns on Facebook. So the question is that an appropriate thing to do? The second question is the following. The people that have, I guess, criticized these guys accused of rape or sexual assault have also demanded that their label drop them and further have demanded that bands on that label get off that label because that label is, quote, supporting rape apologists or sexual assault people. And they have also demanded that bands touring with such accused bands to drop off the tour. To reiterate, the bands have been accused basically by the public at large of sexual crimes but not convicted by a court or anything like that. So we said to the Punk News audience out there, What's the appropriate thing? Should you put these things on Facebook? Should you wait to see if somebody's charged with a crime, or what should you do? Here's what a lot of people wrote in. I'm going to read some condensed versions of some replies. This is from an anonymous person. The person said, "Rape culture in music, particularly in indie and punk and hardcore, is serious and needs to be brought into the light. These kinds of things cannot just be swept under the rug. If a label has a probable rapist or person who commits sexual assault on their roster, the label definitely should drop them from the label. Otherwise, they are promoting rape culture. Simple." And that was an anonymous one. This is from Nguyen. Here's what Nguyen said. "People are innocent until proven guilty. F rumors and rumor culture. Why has the scene forgotten this?" That's from Nguyen. This is from Francis. Francis says, "I don't know why people expect musicians to be good people. I love music, but the fact is many musicians are not nice people. As Adam mentioned on the podcast a while ago, Jimmy Page was involved in some salacious things. Why do people go to musicians for how to act appropriately?" That's from Francis. And this is from Megan. Megan says, "I guess you have to go on a case-by-case basis. The system of innocence and guilt in our society doesn't always work. So sometimes it's best to get dangerous people out of this way, especially in rape scenarios where it is hard for the victim to come forward and the system is weighed against the victim. I think each person has to determine what is right based on what they know. I think requiring people to drop off labels is extreme, but if you are on a tour with a band, you are helping support them financially. A lot of bands only play shows with people who share similar ethos or beliefs, like Propaganda and Anti-Flag. So it is possible." sign Megan. I don't know if Adam or Ricky, if you guys have any thoughts on the thing.
I mean, the guilty until, you know, guilty until proven innocent kind of thing, I tend to lean towards, and I think it should be on a case by case basis. I mean, we've had stories on.
You lean towards guilty until
proven innocent? No, I said it's dangerous to lean towards that. We've had stories on the podcast where, you know, these people were clearly, you know, who is that guy that like gave meth to babies?
False prophets, Ian Watkins.
So we have those people, and then we have the guy from, I think it was Newfound Glory, like was like doing some weird stuff with children on Skype.
I don't know if it was Newfound Glory, but some guy from some band.
Maybe it wasn't that band, but it was a little odd. And then I know we were talking about like how like doesn't this band have like groupies? If you really want to cheat on his wife, then why not do that? Who's like of age?
The guy was accused of going on Skype and whacking off while 14-year-old girls watched him.
Yeah, so there was that one, and then on the completely opposite end, we had another story where this guy was accused of rape, and it turned out he was completely innocent, and it turns out the woman was lying the whole time and dragged his name through the mud.
That was Connor Obrist of Bright Eyes.
Okay, so I think it should be a case by case basis. I mean, and I think it's important. I don't want to tell people not to post this stuff on Facebook if it's true. Like, don't lie about this stuff ever, because what it does, I think, it adds to the suspicion of what a real victim could have. I mean, people might be suspicious of the victim when something actually happened, and you're also telling lies about someone and destroying their reputation. So, but at the same time, if it really happened, like, don't be afraid to go to the authorities and make it a public thing. As for the labels, I think they should just kind of like say they should just give the band an ultimatum: either you admit to this, or you're off, or if you did do this, you're off. We need to figure, like, they need to take an active role. I don't think just automatically kicking them off the label because they're accused of something is necessarily the right way to go. But definitely put them, like just keep it, they should definitely keep an eye on them, though.
I tend to sort of agree with a lot of what Megan had to say. I think, first of all, there is no hard line rule that you can apply in these situations. You have to look at the facts available. I think for posting stuff on Facebook and making a big deal out of it, I think you just have to judge how much facts you have. The fact is, in a lot of these, and actually I think in these four cases we're talking about, maybe the guys were up to some bad stuff, but I certainly don't know. I have no idea whatsoever. But I think in a lot of these cases where people say, oh, so-and-so committed a sexual assault, people have no idea. And I really think if you honestly believe somebody did something bad, then you should make that public. But if you're just going off what somebody told you or what you heard somewhere, you probably shouldn't go along and make that public, because that's kind of lame. Especially if you're wrong, you're ruining somebody's life.
Exactly.
That being said, if the evidence that you have available, that you act, not, you know, oath. What we see a lot in punk news, not punk news, in punk culture, is someone will go on Facebook and say, so-and-so is a rapist. And people say, oh, we need to condemn so-and-so because he's a rapist, with no accounting of facts whatsoever. I think people need to assess the facts at hand beforehand, you know, going on these Facebook sprees. Now, the counter-argument is, well, the victims don't want to come forward. Well, that's fine. Victims don't have to come forward. In that case, you can go to the authorities and handle it that way. Facebook should not be the justice system that we have at hand, but it sort of is right now. It really shouldn't. So like I said, with these large campaigns, I think before you go on and try to destroy somebody's life, you really should be pretty sure that they did what someone's accusing them of. But if you are sure, then you know, I mean, I'm all for bad guys, you know, getting messed up. Should labels support bands that have sexual assault guys on the label? I would say that a label is not responsible for the actions of the people on the label. That being said, it's a case-by-case basis. Did somebody do something bad 30 years ago? Are they sorry? You know, are they not going to do that anymore? You know, then, you know, maybe have them on your label. Is somebody doing something bad right now that's something – like for example, if I had a record label and it turns out one of the guys on the label was a child molester, I would kick him off, you know. But I would only kick him off if I was pretty sure – that what people were saying he was doing was bad was actually bad. So do labels have a responsibility to, I guess, kick off people they think are acting poorly on their label? Well, first of all, it's a business arrangement, so whatever's within the business arrangement they can do. But morally, if somebody's doing something heinous, not bad, but something heinous, the label probably should kick them off if the label genuinely believes and has good evidence that so-and-so was doing something bad. Second and last question, should other bands in the label drop off the label if another band in the label has done something heinous? The answer is no. But, you know, bands, well, first of all, dropping off a label, sometimes you can't because you have a business agreement. But also, most bands are small and they quite simply can't afford to just change their life because someone who's on the same label as them has done something bad. So I think it's wrong to ask bands on a label to drop off that label or go against the label simply because another band is acting bad on that label. You can only control yourself and you can only control the business dealings with the people that you are directly involved with. And so the practicality of you can't force that burden of a band on a band because you're no matter who you work with, there's always going to be bad people tangentially related to you to it. You know maybe the guy that works the pressing plant is a rapist or is a thief or something. So you can always find bad people somewhere. So you can only hold bands accountable to people they work directly with. Lastly, what I was going to say is, should bands drop off tours with, you know, bad guys on the tour? The answer is, this is just my opinion, a band should not book a tour with a guy that you're pretty sure has done heinous things. Now, I don't mean, you know, got in a fist fight or stole. I mean, heinous. We're talking severe, you know, rape, that kind of shit. However, if a band is on a tour with a band and during the tour it comes out that the other band did bad things, the other band does not have a duty to drop off because, like I said, it costs a lot of money to go on tour. A lot of people put their life on hold and make a lot of arrangements. It's not that band's fault that another group of people decided to do bad things. So what they should do is finish up the tour and not tour with that band again. Being on a tour with a band does not mean you agree with what they've done. Does not mean you support what they do. All it means is that you have put an amount of money into a pot to rent out a stage together. That's literally all it means. So you can't require a band, especially a small band, to drop off a tour if while they're on tour it turns out that the other band or one of the other bands has a bad guy in it. It's just too severe of a requirement. That's my opinion.
So when I'm looking at this, there's the two things that kind of crop into my head here is that, one, where is the accusation coming from? And then is that accusation not getting to, like, is it not getting exposed to, like, the authorities that should be looking into this before it's being cycled back to, like, the other musicians and stuff like that that are, like, sort of involved but not at all involved, really? And I think that's maybe the problem. Someone goes on to Tumblr and posts an anonymous message about, you know, this person from this band did this horrible thing. That should absolutely spurn all sorts of investigations and, you know, actual legalities and stuff like that. I don't know if that's at the point where you can go and you can turn around to, you know, the bands that are playing on the same tour as that one and to demand that those bands all of a sudden, like, drop off their tour. Because let's say it's not true. Well, these are small independent artists. You can't just drop off your label, drop off a tour and not incur, you know, either some level of financial hardship or piss a bunch of people off that are supposed to actually, you know, be working with you in the term of you being a musician. So I'd like, you know, I know that there's reasons why these things don't get reported to authorities and that's a problem, but, like, I can understand the kind of weird situation that it puts a band into when all of a sudden we're like, oh, hey, you know that summer tour you booked? We've got word that the drummer in this band that you're touring with is a monster, so you should quit that. And we don't have any proof, you know, that's happening, but the internet says so. And I can appreciate how that is a horrible situation for kind of, like, all involved to be in, because, like, what do you do? The one thing that I thought would be interesting to bring up, though, with regards to this is, let's talk about what a record label is. Because at the very base level, a record label is giving a band some money, loaning a band some money so that they can put out a release. So a record label is, you know, is a bank. Basically, if you want to then go and say, okay, what makes one label different than another? It's all branding. That's all it is. It is all a brand exercise. By the way that the label conducts themselves, the kind of shows they get their bands involved in, the kind of bands they have on their label, that's what makes a label. It's all branding. It's all reputation. So I think a label, just to be completely selfish and to look at it from, say, like their business, a label should absolutely be on top of this shit. Where if all of a sudden they get word that someone in one of these bands is, you know, one of these monsters, and that sounds like a credible threat, the label should be on top of that shit to A, not destroy their brand, and B, to not pull all the other bands on the label that are trusting them to have a good brand, like not to pull all them into that. Like, so I think like of anyone here, I'd look far more on the label to take these accusations absolutely deadly seriously and do whatever diligence that they can to make a decision than I would be to be like, oh, hey, you're the third support band playing with this band whose drummer may or may not be a monster, according to Tumblr. What are you going to do? Right? I would look less to them because they seem like they have less power in this situation than I would the label, because they have something that's actually at stake based on their reputation. And the thing is that the reputation of the label and all the bands on the label, that can suffer and that can screw up all those bands, even if these accusations aren't true or aren't proven or aren't, you know, legally found to be anything. But, you know, reputation is reputation. It's different than law. So that there has to be, you know, some effort on the part of the labels to really be on top of this shit. Because if what happens, you know, is like what we saw in the letter that precipitated this whole conversation, where you have a bunch of people on a bunch of music blogs having these big prolonged discussions over, you know, why aren't these bands dropping off this label that happens to harbor this other band that has this monster in it? Well, at that point, the reputation of your label is shit, and then you're going to have a hard time doing anything.
The problem is there is an element of mob justice here. You know, people say so-and-so is a bad guy, and you have 10,000 people saying that. What does the label do? If a label is purely a brand, they'll drop them no matter what. Does a label have any duty to do what's right as opposed to what's best for the brand?
Well, what's right should be what's best for the brand.
But that's not how it works in real life, though.
Well, no, right? But I mean, like, so, but you would hope that the just thing to do is actually what's good for the label's brand. If the label is in some sort of situation where sticking by the accused band in light of accusations that, you know, will not go away, that will not die out, my inclination would be to, you know, really start and look and say, you know, as a label, you may look and say, you know what, we don't know, band, if you've done this horrible thing or not, and we can't prove it, but our continued business relationship with you is wrecking everything else and all the bands, and we can't sign new bands, and we're having problems booking tours. Like, it could, that reputational stuff is going to start to matter. And I guess the label can't, I don't know if I would feel particularly, label's a business. I don't think that they need to look at it and go like, oh, we need to, you know, fall on our sword for our buddies here that got accused. I'm not saying they should roll over immediately, but at some point, if you have persistent nonstop accusations, if you have something that is going to ruin the label, you know, it's probably safe to break off that business relationship. I'm not saying you have to take the band and throw them into a wood chipper or anything like that, but, you know, the business relationship, maybe that doesn't need to survive in that case.
Adam White giving deference to shareholder primacy. How Glenn Beckian of you, Adam.
Ha
ha! Adam, man, let's chop it up. Let's play a song, man. What do you got?
Oh, I have a song that has everything to do with this show. It should become our new theme song.
Oh, I'm sorry. You can reach us at podcast@punknews.org. Reach us at podcast@punknews.org. We love your mail. I'm sorry, Adam. Chop it up. What do you got?
Yes, and when you're emailing us at podcast@punknews.org, say, play more of that song and talk less about difficult social topics. this is a band. They're from Sackville, New Brunswick, which, if you know Canadian music at all, is a weird little hotbed of strange music. They're playing the Ottawa Explosion that is happening this weekend. They're probably playing, what is today, Wednesday?
Today's Wednesday.
Yeah, okay. So they're actually playing tonight. And it's a band that has all kinds of crazy, weird, quirky material. You should totally look up the live video of them playing this song in front of a barn in a field. But anyways, this band is called Kappa Chow, K-A-P-P-A-C-H-O-W. This song is called Punk as Fuck, and it is the new theme song of the Punk News Podcast, unless I'm overruled on this. Here we go.
Kappa Chow! Kappa Chow! Kappa Chow!
And we're back. Let's talk about everybody's favorite band, at least one of my favorite bands, the Beastie Boys. As you know, a little while ago, Monster Energy Drink put up a commercial on their website that had Beastie Boys music in the background, and at the end of the commercial, it put RIP MCA. They did this just days after MCA passed away from cancer, and in his will, it explicitly stated that he did not want his music used in any commercial. So, of course, the Beastie Boys sued Monster, and they won $1.7 million in damages from Monster. Afterwards, Monster said, "We don't think that's fair." Monster said, "We don't think that's fair, even though we took the Beastie Boys music without permission and used it to sell our alien piss drink. Even though MCA said he did not want his music used for commercials, we don't think that is fair. They're getting $1.7 million. We're going to appeal." So after that, the Beastie Boys asked the court to award them attorney's fees and other legal costs. They were asking for $2.4 million, but the judge just this week only awarded them $668,000. The judge said in his decision, "The Beastie Boys chose a Cadillac Escalade route instead of a Honda Civic route." So basically, right now, the Beastie Boys have won $1.7 million in damages from Monster and almost $700,000 in legal fees. And I think this is kind of bullshit. I think the Beastie Boys should get $2.4 million or something close to that. And I'll tell you why. This underscores a very important point in the American jurisprudence system and a very large problem. The problem is this is, the way the courts are weighted right now, you can get attorney's fees. Bigger parties, stronger parties, can get much more attorney fees than smaller parties simply because they hire more expensive and bigger and more costly attorneys. And this is a real problem. In California, they have something called a 998 form. And essentially that says, I send somebody a 998 form and it says, unless you settle with me for this amount, then if you win less than this amount at trial, then I get my fees and costs back. The problem is, you know, I'm an attorney at a small office. Our fees and costs in a two-year-long lawsuit might be $50,000. So if I send a 998 and let's say I win more than my settlement offer, then $50,000 to a bank is like 2 cents. But let's say the bank sends me a 998 and I don't accept it and then they get fees and costs. Even if I win, let's say I win $300,000 at trial, but their 998 was for $315,000, they're going to hit me with a cost bill for $3 million. So even though my client won $300,000 and the bank was wrong, my client instead has to pay the bank $2.7 million because it did not accept what's called the 998. And that's what we see happening here. There is a significant weight towards large businesses with large firms in the American jurisprudence system. My question is this: why should the Beastie Boys have to have a Honda Civic litigation route, suggesting a economic, small, not powerful route? If the bank won against the Beastie Boys, I mean not the bank, if Monster won legal fees against the Beastie Boys, it would be $4 million, and the court would say, yep, you've got super expensive attorneys, $4 million, you got it, click. Just because the Beastie Boys are smaller, and let's be direct here, the Beastie Boys are rich, but Monster is worth something like $3 billion. No, Monster is worth $10 billion. So simply because Monster is a bigger company, they're entitled to more legal fees than the Beastie Boys would be, simply because Monster knows how to waste money more. So I think it's despicable that the judge is telling them that they should have to litigate a Honda Civic route, particularly where the courts give deference to large corporations that have very expensive attorneys. So I wish the Beastie Boys got, you know, maybe 1.5 million, 2 million. I hope 700,000 is enough. But as the judge even said, he said he thinks the Beastie Boys will turn a profit in the case. That's a poor way of looking at it. The point isn't to turn a profit. The point for the Beastie Boys is to compensate for their damages. So when you sue somebody, the point is not to come out $10 ahead, $10,000 ahead. The point is to come out whatever your damages are plus your legal fees. So here, the court is essentially admitting that even though the Beastie Boys were damaged $1.7 million, they're not going to collect for their total assessment in damages simply because the lawsuit dragged out for so long. That is to say, it's the theory suggested is the longer a lawsuit gets out, the less damages you get, when really it should be the opposite. So I think this shows one of the weaker characteristics of the American justice system. And also, it just goes to show what kind of scumbags Monster are, and here's why. $2 million a Monster is nothing. Monster is a $10 billion company. $2 million is like $200 to me and you. So they should have just settled the case. They should have just said, okay, Beastie Boys, we'll give you $2 million, we'll give you $1.5 million before even going to trial. But this goes to show you what kind of dirtbags Monster is. The only reason Monster litigated this case was basically just to try to push the Beastie Boys around, or because their attorneys wanted to make money and Monster was not smart enough to say, why don't we just settle it? Because it's not like Monster's trying to establish any sort of precedent. It's not like it was a slip and fall case. It's not like it was whether or not a certain car was put together within safety standards. Monster clearly was in the wrong here by using the Beastie Boys' music without permission. They're wrong. There's no way around that. There's no way you can establish a precedent that says that's an okay thing to do. So Monster's sole purpose of litigating this was try to beat the Beastie Boys down through money. And in a way, they have, because the court only awarded the Beastie Boys $700,000 instead of a more fair amount, in my opinion. So Monster's bullshit. I'm glad the Beastie Boys won the case. I'm a little bummed that the judge would use such language, and that the Beastie Boys would have to do a, quote, Honda Civic litigation instead of a Cadillac, when really the Beastie Boys were clearly in the right here. So that's my opinion.
What make and model of metaphorical car do you litigate with?
That's actually one of our key strategies, and I use this quite a bit, is our law firm, our law firm only has three attorneys. We've got three attorneys, two paralegals, one office manager. That's a very small firm. And so it's for me to file a motion, I don't know, costs $3,000, $4,000, you know, maybe less. For the bank to file a motion, it literally costs $30,000, $40,000. So the bank will purposely try to delay things against me because they think they're wearing me down. But really, they're weighing themselves down because, you know, the bank will file four or five frivolous motions. They're out $200,000. And so hopefully, and I'm glad when they do that, because they're already at $200,000. They haven't made any footing. Hopefully the bank themselves will see that the bank's attorneys have charged them $200,000, and they could have settled the case for $300,000. So why are they wasting their money? They should just settle the case. What the bank thinks in my corner is, the bank thinks all my clients are just, quote, money-hungry people that just want to get a quick $10,000, quick $20,000. But in my case, my clients generally are people that are willing to go the distance and wait two or three or 4 years to really go to trial, to really get, you know, a fair share of damages. So the key mistake the bank makes, and I hope none of the opposing counsels are listening to this, is they think they can wear me down over 2 or 3 years with lots of frivolous motions, but it's quite the opposite, because motions to me are extremely cheap, about as cheap as it gets. And when I say cheap, I mean, what does it cost for us to put together a motion or a response, where to the bank is very expensive, particularly in regards to the value of the case.
So that's like a GMC Savannah cargo van.
Oh, so the question is, like our litigation vehicle is like a van with duct tape windows, you know, old, you know, a 1972, you know, VW bus, because it cost me almost nothing to file a response to the motion, and that's why we succeed, and that's why we don't take small settlements, because we go the distance, because we're in the right, and we don't let the banks push us around, which they usually try to do. Not always, but usually. So,
but you could not pass like an e-test or anything like that.
well, I don't want to say that, because the California bar might say, oh, he's implying that he's not acting competently. I assure you, all our motions are extremely competent, extremely well done. I'm just saying they're very cheap for us. So what's a Ford Focus? We drive around in a Ford Focus. You know, a nice, reliable, newish car, but very cheap to maintain, very cheap to get from point A to point B. The Ford Focus, manual even, not even automatic, manual. So anyway.
All right, so we're going to break out of this metaphor because we have other things we need to talk about. So I'm going to jump to the next story. We got to go.
Adam, I want to talk about law all night long in the punk.
No, I want to keep murdering that metaphor until it's not funny. I don't know if it was. Anyways, Against Me. Guys, Against Me have been teasing this new live album for a while, and they finally have put out the details on it. So here's what's going on. The album is going to be called 23 Live Sex Acts by Against Me. That's acts, A-C-T-S, not acts, A-X-E. although that would be cool too.
Sex acts.
Yeah, so the 23 Live Sex Acts by Against Me. It's coming out on September 4th on Total Trouble Music, which is the label that the band owns that put out Transgender Dysphoria Blues. So you can find a pre-order link on Punk News. You can download a live version of True Trans Soul Rebel now and check that out. And it's actually on all the streaming services and things like that too, if you want to go find it there. The cover art is considered a little bit not safe for work because there may or may not be a decapitated penis on it. Is that decapitated the right word?
No, severed. Decapitated.
Severed? Decapitated means, yes.
The head's anyways, cut off. So you could severed. Have a decapitated penis, but this is not a decapitated penis. This is a yes, severed yes. penis.
All right. Anyways, severed penis. So you can go check that out if you want to go check that out. I don't think it's all that offensive, especially when you compare it to some other things. But hey, there's 23 songs on this. They come from pretty much across the band's career. You know, there's stuff from Axl Rose on here. There's you know, interesting to see. There's quite a few songs on here that are from their two Sire records. So it's not like they're shying away from that stuff. So you guys can go check that out. I'll ask your opinion on this in a minute. I have two questions to put this out to you beforehand. Question number one, and this just goes to the general public, and it's not really a question, it's a statement. Back in 1994, the Australian pop punk band Frenzel Rom put out an EP called Dick Sandwich. And if you ask me, the cover art to Dick Sandwich, go look it up, is way more offensive than the cover art to this. And I don't really want to look at the cover to Dick Sandwich, but I could look at the cover to this. So just putting that out there for anyone that wants to go look up something gross.
I'm looking at it right now.
Yeah, that's way worse, isn't it?
Yeah, it's worse. Yeah, but see, the Against Me is, see, this is a drawing, and the Against Me thing looks more like a photo, and I think a photo is a little bit more shocking than the drawing.
Yeah, but it's a photo that's in, like, that, like, super washed out Rancid Vision where, you know, it's all just...
How come no one's getting on Against Me for using Rancid O Vision? That's totally what Against Me's been doing.
Yeah, so anyways, though, by all means, Punk News Podcast listenership, go look up that Frenzel Rom EP because it's gross. But anyways... Ricky, I'm going to throw this story to you because you have an apparently infamous beef with Against Me from this show.
No, I don't.
The commenters on Punk News are just stoking the fires of your hate. So
where?
Well, your Miley Cyrus rant.
Okay, fine. That was an anti Miley Cyrus rant, but no, Against Me, as I've said this before, they are my favorite band. And I got to tell you, they haven't done really a live album since, I think Americans Abroad came out, I think 2006 when they were still on Fat. So that was live. That was a Live in London album.
It was the last thing that they had on Fat, wasn't it?
I believe so. And so this is, I think, this is the right time. I mean, they have two. I mean, since so much has changed since that album, since their last live album came out. So
that's the truth, man. That is the truth. How many band members? Just Large Jane Grace, right?
No, well, James, you can argue also has been around. He's been around since Axl Rose.
He's on the other live album too.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they've gone through two drummers. Well, technically three, and then. I think Inge's their third bassist technically. I know Andrew was on for a long time, but now it's now they're we have Adam and Inge now. So I mean since so much has changed, again, this is such a good time to be doing this. I think they really have a good set list of everything they've done. I saw Against Me four times since Transgender Dysphoria Blues. I'm sorry, 5 times since Transgender Dysphoria Blues came out. Every show was fucking spectacular, and I'm really glad to hear that the True Trans Soul Rebel, just judging by that track, I'm really glad that the live production is really good, at least so far, because sometimes live albums can have you know, okay to borderline bad production, but this sounds really good, really professional, very a big and varied set list throughout, that kind of touch on everything they've done throughout the career. And then I had something written down where, actually the pre-order just started today. And what's interesting about the pre-order, well, first of all, the pre-order started in the UK, but today when, for the US, it went up on Amazon.com, which I found interesting because everything else they've put out, like since Total Treble was a thing, has been through the Total Treble website. So I wonder why they kind of decided to make that change. But I mean, I am so looking forward to this. And I actually have my pre-order in already. So yeah, get this. It's going to be awesome. And I think it's going to be like a triple LP. So for you vinyl nerds, that's cool. Going to be great.
Yeah, the only time I've seen Against Me was actually for the Transgender Dysphoria Blues tour, and I mean, like I said before, I was not a big Against Me fan. The tour and the album made me a fan. The best live albums and the best live shows are always for me when a band kind of re-identifies themselves, recasts themselves, or comes back with a certain mission. Best live album ever, Rolling Stones Live in Texas in 1978, and that's when they were like punk rockers for a few years, or used kind of the punk rock sound or genre. Trappings, if you will, and so like they did the entire Some Girls album and about 6 or 7 other songs, but in a punk rock style. I love it when a band kind of like, you know, or how about Bowie, when Bowie did Station to Station, and he did almost all of Station to Station on the Station to Station tour, but he also did some of his older stuff in the Thin White Duke persona instead of his glam rock Ziggy Stardust persona. That's always the most exciting, fun live albums for me. I think that's what this is for Against Me. I do kind of wish that, I know almost the entire new album is on it, but I kind of wish there was a greater focus on the new album, in that I kind of wish those songs were earlier on in the set. You know, this really almost reads like a greatest hits set, and I think it would have been a little bit more powerful if it was a Transgender Dysphoria Blues set with some other songs sprinkled in. That being said, I think this is a good way to cap off the current Against Me cycle. A lot of people have been saying, you know, enough with the transgender thing, and I didn't used to feel that way. You know, I think that's an interesting thing for the band to talk about, and this band has always been extremely self-referential, so I think it's great that they're talking about that. But I do agree that, you know, that they've been dwelling on this topic now for like 2 or 3 years now, and so not that it's not a valid topic to touch, but Against Me has really focused on it so much, I'm ready for Against Me to move on to the next thing, because I felt they've done this about as well as they can and given it enough focus. So I'm hoping this is kind of like the cap to this era of Against Me, and then they move on to another central concept next.
Can I respond to that real quick before we get to Adam? I've been kind of on the fence about that. I mean, I think Laura's, I think, is always going to be like that, you know, trans activist on the side from the band. Because I haven't put out anything since Transgender Dysphoria Blues came out, except for like a couple EPs. I think that's why they're also, it seems like it's being a lot more magnified. So I think I'd be interested to see what will happen with their next album.
Yeah.
It'll still focus on it, but probably I wouldn't say as much. That would be my guess. Also about it being a best of or album. I think the way this was done was they recorded a bunch of shows throughout the tour, throughout like the last year or two, and they just chose the best recordings, live recordings of each song, and then put the best ones together to make this album.
I kind of hate that, honestly, to tell you the truth.
I think that's what happened.
I prefer just one live show, even if certain songs aren't perfect. I think the live show is one element, as one night translates much better than a greatest hit set or different. I mean, I look at the two Clash live albums. Live at Shea Stadium is way better than From Here to Eternity.
Yeah, I love Live at Shea Stadium, but I think what I would hope that they would do at least is I was kind of hoping they would maybe say like where each song was like performed at like the venue and what city was it, but that's just me. Adam,
that's always the problem, right? Is that whenever you have a live album, the question kind of comes as to like how live is this and how much is it just, you know, the remnants of a live recording that they fixed in the studio with a bunch of overdubs and whatever else, right? And like that always becomes a problem. I mean, that like the famous example of that is like the Kiss Alive record that, you know, that came out and then everyone accused it of not actually being real. So there's, you know, that's always a problem. And on the one hand, the From Here to Eternity route, you get the sense that like, yeah, these are a bunch of cherry picked, you know, live recordings from this show or that show that have been cleaned up. Right. I don't really know my point is on this. I don't really know what I prefer, but I mean, that's the problem. I mean, there's an inherent problem in live records is that you always kind of come back down to this authenticity problem that you never have if it's a studio recording. And the question is how much does that matter? Like if it sounds really good, but it's a live record, but there's a big asterisk next to live, which is like, you know, well, you know, the drums came through okay, but we had to go through and like re-record all the bass lines in studio. Like, is that, if it still sounds good, does that make it a shitty live record?
Well, I don't think they recorded anything. I think they just kind of chose, I think this is what was going on. They just kind of chose the best live version that they recorded throughout the tour.
But I mean, it's still manipulated to a degree, right? It's not just a set. You don't hear the band getting tired after, you know, playing this many songs, or like you don't, you know, hear something change with the mood of the crowd or whatever like that, right? Like it's a manufactured product, right? But I guess that's my question. I don't know. Maybe this is like a question for people to write us in for. Does that shit matter? Like, would you rather your live record be, you know, the straight off the board bootleg of like, this is what happened at this show at this time? Like those Fugazi live recording giant collection that they released online? Or, you know, is it something that you want it to be a bit curated and actually made something listenable? So, yeah.
Good question.
That is a good question.
Podcast at punknews.org. I'll tell you, speaking of things with a lot of manipulation, a lot of behind the scene work, Apple has announced Apple Music. What Apple Music is going to be, it's going to be a hub where you can stream music, download music, and use a radio service. It's going to be $10 a month. The first 3 months are free. And you can get it on June 30th on Apple devices, and around the world in the fall. Adam White, you chastised me for this article. So I'm curious as to your opinion on this. Did you chastise me for the greater punk news good, or did you chastise me because you love Apple and everything that Steve Jobs does, and you want to have all of Steve Jobs' babies? What happened?
As much as I would love to have a dead man's babies. I chastised you because if you want to do this here, your article was super biased and snarky and not very punk newsy. It was very much more like, this is what should go on John's Tumblr. So
that's because Apple is evil. That's why.
Sure, but that's not news. That's opinion. Unless you have like the footage of, you know, Tim Cook beating someone to death with a tire iron. You have to infer the evil, not explicitly state.
If you look at this article of Punk News, like I used a stock photo issued by Apple of Steve Jobs. I can't believe they used that as like a photo of him. He looks so sinister in that photo. He looks downright evil in that photo.
All right. So anyways, let's talk about this.
But you agree, Adam, just yes or no. Does Steve Jobs look evil?
Let me pull up the story here.
He looks evil in that photo. He looks like Dr. Evil or something.
Yeah.
I can't believe they use that photo.
In retrospect, if anyone else was to have that photo, it would be pretty evil. That was during Steve Jobs, during his, you know, the entire world considers him a genius phase. And if the entire world considers you a genius, you can release like a total supervillainy photo. Anyways, let's get back to this Apple Music thing, because I think it is interesting and worth discussing. Maybe not. I want to actually discuss this and not discuss like your straw man of his Apple evil. So the first thing, first of all, I don't know about anyone else, but like I found the whole presentation about this completely impenetrable in that I was not watching the keynote of this when it came out, and the information afterwards all seems to be all over the place on it. So like the initial question that I had was that, okay, so how is this different than, you know, Spotify? And that I always want to say Spotify and RDO because I use RDO, but I guess that must be the small fish. But anyways, how is this different than existing services like Spotify, RDO, or a friend Tidal, right? Or something like that. Outside of, you know, size of library, because size of library isn't interesting to me. I mean, that's the dick measuring contest, right? Like, oh, we're going to have 37 million songs in our library and they only have 30 or whatever it is. And where this maybe gets a little bit interesting to me is not so much in the Apple has a streaming service now aspect of it. I mean, yeah, there's lots of those, whatever. And this is priced pretty much in line with the rest of them. And I don't think it's that interesting that Apple has gone and launched these 24-hour DJ, you know, curated radio stations that are going to go with this. I mean, that's interesting to a degree, but to me, that's more of a vanity thing. Like, it's part of their brand to be seen as, you know, very artist friendly and you know, very in tune with, you know, what's going on in the artistic world and whatever. So for Apple to go and to pay a bunch of DJs to make a, you know, high quality 24-hour around the clock, you know, radio station for them, that's fine. It's not really a technology thing. That's just a new radio thing that they've done. It really has nothing to do with anything outside of them. They wanted to do that. The interesting part to this, and I was actually having a conversation online with our buddy Jason Tate, who runs Absolute Punk, about this, and we were having the same kind of conversation, is the Apple Music Connect portion of this. This is the aspect of this service where they want to encourage, or at least they're saying, they want to encourage artists to go in upload their music, upload their own shit, post their news, post their tour dates, post their whatevers, right? There's a social network aspect to it, and that's okay. But I think the more interesting part is that they want to encourage musicians to go in and upload their stuff. That, to me, is the interesting part of this. And it's only interesting because of Apple's size. They have the marketing muscle and the install base of their products that they could make something like that gain some traction. So compare this to, say, any of the existing services. I'm going to take a band that I like and use them to kind of illustrate this. So I've played like a bunch of stuff from the Dirty Nil on this show. I love the Dirty Nil. Now, this is a band that has released nothing to this point but like 5 or 6 7-inches and a 10-inch. And the only thing that I could go on to say RDO or Spotify and pull up is the 7-inch that they released on Fat. And it's because Fat's a big enough label that they had people that went and uploaded their music to these services. If I want to go listen to any of the other stuff that they've released, and it's, say, something I've gotten a download code for, well, I've got to go into iTunes and listen to the MP3 of it that I have here or put on the record. I can't go into one of the streaming services and play these things. So it's not totally clear to me if, let's say, you're the Dirty Nil, how do you get these, you know, 8 or 10 songs that you have that you've released independently in various stripes or in collaboration with little labels and get them into all the things? How do you get them into the places where everyone's going to be able to access them? And you can do it right now. There's a method to do it, but it differs depending on what kind of service you're getting into. I don't know the particulars on this, but, you know, so for example, Spotify, for example, might give you an artist login where you can go do that stuff. But one of the other services might want you to go through a label. And then there's different music distributor middlemen that exist to allow bands to do this. I know that CD Baby does this as a service for bands right now. And there's a bunch of like digital middlemen companies that are like, oh, are you a band? You want to get your music on all the things? We will upload your music for a fee and get it onto all the things, right? If Apple gains a fair amount of popularity with this, it might mean that you could be, you know, the John Gentile harmonica one man band that records on your, you know, on your computer in your bedroom. Does that mean that you can get an account on this, go create your artist page, and upload music into what would presumably be like the biggest, most universally accepted digital music market, and then just start interacting that way?
How is that different than iTunes?
Well, I mean, it's different than iTunes in that I don't think as an independent artist, you can just go and just like flip of the switch, get your music into iTunes. I think you still have those kind of middlemen, don't you?
Yeah, you have to get a service that can upload it for you, but it's still relatively simple. I mean, anybody that spends 4 hours can get their music up on iTunes.
Sure, but what I'm getting at here is that it's 4 hours for iTunes, it's 4 hours for this, 4 hours for that. If this, and I hate to be saying this because it means that it sounds like I'm almost encouraging them to like dominate the market, but if this becomes as big enough a thing as Apple has the potential to make it, that might change the game somewhat as far as how much leverage you as an independent artist have to go take your stuff and to get it into the masses' eyes. So there's that aspect to it that I think is interesting, but I don't entirely, you know, I don't even know if I'm pro or anti that, because like for that utopian vision to work, it would have to mean that Apple crushes all these competitors and you only have to upload your things.
Yeah, but see, the problem with that, Adam, is Apple is incredibly vicious with regards to licensing and rights. I can almost guarantee you that if you upload stuff to the Apple service, they maintain some sort of ownership or license over it. And say they crush all of the other like competition, like you're suggesting, then Apple will just get worse. Apple is one of the worst companies when it comes to privacy and ownership of licensing of rights.
Yes, so that's why I think that aspect of this, I'm not pro or against it. I think that's the interesting aspect in all this.
Like, I'm against it.
I don't think I know you're against it, yes. It's not interesting to me that they have a streaming service. It's interesting to me how this is going to become, like, what kind of interaction an independent artist is going to have to come into this. So that part is interesting. The selfish part of me that's looking at this is, so the selfish part is that there's this Apple service that they have called iTunes Match, which allows me to take what's in my iTunes library and it shoves it up into the cloud, and then I can access it from any of my devices.
But they have ownership of it or license.
Well, I don't know about that. But hold on, let me tell you my selfish thing here. So my selfish thing is that right now, so I have iTunes Match, takes the music that's on my computer, shoves it into the cloud. So that means if I'm on my phone, I could pull up that Dirty Nil song that I only had an MP3 of, or shit, I can pull up on my phone the, you know, a hunk of recording for the Punk News mixtape that we made as an MP3 when we were making it and stuck it on iTunes, right? So all that stuff is shared amongst my devices because I used iTunes Match. If they had like a totally seamless experience where I could pull up the stuff that I've uploaded, and I could pull up the stuff from the streaming library at the same time and just playlist that stuff together and not know one or the other. To me, as a consumer, that's interesting. Because right now, I got to pull up RDO if I'm in my office and listen to this or that music. But I've got to go pull up iTunes to go listen to the actual MP3s that I've put in. And then if I'm on my phone, same thing. Well, if I can just sign up for this one Apple service and it takes this giant library of streaming and then it takes the MP3s I've independently uploaded just for my own consumption and allows me to playlist all that stuff together, then that's kind of cool. That would be nice. I'm not, again, that's my selfish look at it. I'm not ascribing good or evil to any of that, but like, hey, that would be cool. But yeah.
See, I'm against it because what that leads to is stuff like RDO, where you pay a fee to rent access to a service and you don't actually own any music whatsoever and you lose control over the music you want to listen to and you're basically at the whims of Apple. So I'm against it. I'm pro Bandcamp. I'm pro SoundCloud. Reasonable fees and you get ownership of the music, and when you upload music, you don't sign away rights to anybody else.
So here's a good question. There was a rumor going around for a long time that SoundCloud was actually going to be bought by Twitter, because the idea, at least that when the rumor was going around, was that Twitter was looking for, you know, some sort of media angle that they didn't have, and SoundCloud was, you know, could have filled that void. Would that kind of thing drive you squirrely?
It would, but I actually like Bandcamp a lot better than SoundCloud's kind of a piece of crap, honestly, in that like there's so much junk on SoundCloud. It's not as user friendly. If somebody bought Bandcamp, I'd get more worried about that. I'd like Bandcamp a lot. I would too.
If someone bought Bandcamp, I think a lot of us would be really, really bummed, because there's something about – I mean, that's the thing. Is like SoundCloud can be useful and all that stuff, but I never get the impression that like that the people that run SoundCloud are all that altruistic about anything. Like to me, like SoundCloud is someone's startup. Like it's a business. Like they're waiting for – they're waiting for the company to come along and to give them $1 billion so that they can turn around and pay off all their angel investors and then buy a boat, right? Like that to me is what SoundCloud seems like. Like it's neat and everything, but it's one of these San Francisco-y, you know, tech company things.
Even the name SoundCloud.
Right. Right.
Like, two syllables. Like, that's the rule up there.
But Bandcamp, two syllables. But Bandcamp, I don't know. Bandcamp feels to me like it's actually like made by people that have some interaction with independent artists. Like,
you know why? I think it's because it's really Bandcamp for listening to bands is the best way to do it. It's like click on the album. Here's the songs. You can listen to all the songs as the album or individual ones. I think Bandcamp is formed by people that actually enjoy music. While SoundCloud, you know, it's like, it's got just like, here's a stream of this song, and then here's a stream of this random song. It's a pain in the ass to make like a playlist or an album. It'll just start randomly playing other songs if you don't have one selected.
SoundCloud to me feels over-engineered. Like when you get on there and they have like, oh, you can comment at random points in the song, right? Like I look at that feature and I go like, okay, like, yeah, that's kind of neat, but no band was asking for that. That's something where like, you know, the product guys had to get together in a room at one point and go like, how do we differentiate our product from the competitors? And they came up with some bullshit.
See, I love it when people put, ooh, I love this part. That gives me so much information. So I'm like, ooh, this is a great part. Speaking of a great part, let's play a song, boys. What do you think?
I was hoping to get a
word in on this. Go ahead, Ricky.
No, Ricky, go.
Okay. So, when this whole Apple thing came up, I kind of came at it from like a consumer point of view. How should I put this? I got worried that this Apple Music will eventually phase out the iTunes Store and iTunes altogether. I think what maybe record companies are finding is streaming, although it's not as lucrative as selling like a CD, I think it seems to be a good compromise for those who don't want to pay a lot for music or anything for music to stop the torrenting, and to get them from torrenting and ripping music off to just doing streaming. And Apple has been in this like interesting like motion where they kind of are phasing things out so that so that they can get all one, like the iOS platform on all of their stuff. And it's not necessarily a good thing. Personally, I think like Tidal, I have a feeling this will flop. I don't care how big Apple is. They have had their flops in the past. You can go as far back as, you know, you can go as far back as you want to. They, in the early 90s, Apple, believe it or not, actually had a game console that failed. And recently, like in 2006, 7 or 8, they had something called, on iTunes called Ping, and that was like supposed to be a social media aspect to iTunes that that pretty much failed also. I hope it fails because I like owning my music. I hope they don't phase out iTunes. I'm all about vinyl and Bandcamp, really.
So as being someone that's all about vinyl and Bandcamp I appreciate being able to get a hold of music online for the convenience aspect of it.
Right.
And what's, to me, the ideal situation is that I buy a record and then I get the little piece of paper that says, go download the MP3s from here. Then I'm happy. Right.
Right.
Because then, I mean, going back to what I was saying earlier about iTunes Match, then I can take them and upload them and then they're everywhere for me. And then that's fine. Right. Do you actually buy records out of iTunes all that much? Because I find just like myself, I never buy music out of iTunes. I always find that I'm either like if I want to spend money on it, I want to go get the record. And if I don't want to spend money on it, but I just kind of want to hear it and it's not really that important to me, then I'll listen to it on RDO or something like that. Like I have a hard time figuring out where iTunes fits into that equation.
For me, it's like if it's not a, if a band couldn't get the a pressing for whatever reason, like if they couldn't afford the pressing, iTunes is usually like my last, unless they're on Bandcamp. I'll do Bandcamp before iTunes. iTunes is like my last resort. But when it comes to like the like using the cloud like the way you do, I don't try in terms of like and this goes back to John's skepticism of Apple's privacy policies. I won't go near the cloud. I don't trust the cloud for any company, whether it's like Microsoft or Apple. I would much rather have all my stuff backed up on a hard drive where I can get it and not have to rely on them. I'd rather be self-reliant in that aspect.
So why are you worried if like the iTunes music MP3 store goes away?
Because let's say I were to get an album off Bandcamp, where am I going to put those MP3s if iTunes is gone and all there is Apple Music?
Oh, well, I mean, there'll be music players or libraries and shit like that. Like, I don't think that's the worry. I thought you were more worried about like your ability to go spend $9.99 to purchase, you know, the latest Nicki Minaj record.
Oh yeah.
Nicki Minaj is cool, man.
I'm just saying, I picked an artist.
And also, I don't know if you guys know this, back to Bandcamp. I don't know if you know this, but there was an article that came out a few months ago where actually Bandcamp has made $100 million in transactions this year. And so if that comes out, I would not be surprised if they either get bought out soon or if they've already gotten offers. So who Bandcamp? Knows where that's going to go. Yeah. I would
they
not be
build su- like a big golden... what's it called? Front end loader, and just drive over orphanages with it. Really fuck with people's value systems. Then. You thought you liked us?
So yeah, that's just my two cents on that stuff.
Ricky, right. Play a song.
All right, I got a song. And here it is.
Four goddesses, 29, 95. Compliant planet sail. $29.95. Four goddesses while supplies last.
So that was Bad Cop, Bad Cop. Ricky, one of Ricky's favorite bands or favorite new bands. The record's called Not Sorry. It's out already. Ricky gave it a 9 out of 10. Ricky, are you digging? Ricky, why does Bad Cop, Bad Cop resonate with you? Why should the kids listen to Bad Cop, Bad Cop? What's special about Bad Cop, Bad Cop?
Well, first, let me just say that song was called Cheers off Bad Cop's album, Not Sorry. You can find them on Bandcamp, Twitter, Facebook. The album came on a lovely red translucent vinyl record that arrived at my house a couple days ago. You can catch them on a Southwest tour for their album release shows. The reason why people should be listening to Bad Cop, Bad Cop is, you know, I've said on this podcast before, like, I get picky when it comes to like that very melodic pop punk. It took me a while to get into Mass Intruder until I saw them live, and I'd much rather see them live than put their album on. Teenage Bottle Rocket, I couldn't really get into until this most recent album. This is a pop punk band that, first of all, has fantastic vocal harmonies. They are absolutely sincere, and they're not just this. If you're looking something for that's different than the usual like Ramones core kind of thing, this might be the band this might be a band you should check out. I gave the album a 9 out of 10 because if you listen to their first two EPs, you'll see they've made quite some leaps and bounds here. It's a very creative album. All the songs sound different, but as a unit in an album, they all really work well together. I think Fat Mike did a really good job on production here. He was head of that. And, I think they have an advantage that the fact that it's an all-female band, which is, I think, a breath of fresh air. So you kind of get a different vocal feel. And different kind of aspects in lyrically. You can read my review. It's up on the right where all the new reviews are. So give it a listen. I really enjoy this band. They put on a great show. Have you two been able to give this album a spin? And what'd you guys think of it?
I thought it was cool, man. I think Bad Cop is kind of just doing rock and music. They merged the pop, I guess, with a little bit. What's cool about Bad Cop, Bad Cop is they kind of do the sugar sweet pop punk thing, but they've got some humor in there too. It's not like overkill, and I think the humor involved in the music is what really brings it through, particularly with songs like Joey Lawrence, which was already done by a band called Flat Planet, who became Narboots. But hey, who's saying? who's keeping score?
You were just like, how can I talk about Narboots?
Hey, man, Narboots had actually, Flat Planet had a song called Joey Lawrence in 1998. That was almost 20 years ago. So I'm just saying.
Yeah, this is good. I mean, my biggest criticism of it is that it kind of sounds like I expected it to sound on the first few songs. And I don't really know what that means. there's a certain... There's a certain Fat Wreck sound that, you know, whether it's, you know, one of their classic bands or whether it's like a female fronted band, they all kind of, most of their stuff outside of Your Morning Glories and whatnot tend to circle back to.
Nightbirds.
This is a lot closer to like a core fat wreck sounding fat wreck band than I think some of the stuff that we've heard from them in the past. And yeah, that's cool. I've only gotten a couple songs into this, so I'm actually looking forward to sitting down and spinning the whole thing.
It's a very it's one of those albums that's very easy listen. It's easy listening. I agree. It has that, like, you know, quote unquote fat wreck sound. It's just like that harmless pop punk with definitely with some edge and attitude. And I think they bring something just different to the pop punk table. And I encourage people to listen to the EPs, I think, before this album. That's just my opinion. Just to see how much they've made quite a bit of improvements. And if you can see them, they put on a really fun show. I know they'll be at Fest, and they're playing that 25th anniversary Fat Wreck tour. So check them out for sure.
Well, cool. I think that's it, eh? I think we're running long tonight.
Yeah, man. We're really chewing the fat today, man.
You want to argue about Apple more?
Yeah, well, see, that's the thing. I don't – maybe the kids can give us some feedback. We've been starting podcasts a lot by having extended discussions that aren't about news, that are just kind of about topics we think are interesting. I don't know if the kids are into that or not. I think it's interesting, but maybe we do it a tad too much. I don't know. I'll have to think about that. I don't know what you guys think.
I like adding a personal aspect to the podcast, but, I mean, I'm not, like, attached to it or anything like that, because I know – originally, that was never really part of the
agenda.
Like the agenda, yeah.
Hey, if it was up to me, we wouldn't talk about anything but whatever we happen to talk about.
maybe we should do that sometime, man. Maybe we should just kick back, chill, talk about Melvins, and that's it. You know.
Anyway, so it'll be like 80% Melvins instead of 60.
Well, write us in about your favorite Melvin's memories. Podcast at pugnews.org. We'll see you next week.